You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's program is an edited recording of a conversation I had in 1989 with Rose Lauder, prolific and rigorous filmmaker and co-founder with Alan Alcide Soudre of the Archives of Experimental Film in Avignon, France.
Absolutely no ambition to make any films at this moment. When I was in BBC, which was a steady job, this is the period that corresponded to my studio in Great Portland Street. That was the period when I took on the studio at Great Portland Street. I actually took the risk to take that place on just before I got the job at BBC, while I was working my first company. But that was a peaceful period because, you know, before I went to BBC, I would work a couple of hours in the morning on my sculpture, and I work in the evening, and I work a lot on the weekends. So that was quite a rich period for me, because I think London was very alive in those days. There were a lot of colourful things going on. I used to walk through the East End and pick up a lot of wood for my sculpture. And, you know, I liked found things. I used to go through the flea markets in the East End. I had a friend who was interested in collecting things, you know, I used to go with him, and there were lots of sort of influences of that sort, which were new to me, and
So when did you leave the, when did you leave the BBC?
Well, I left the BBC partly because of Alain. Alain was in Paris and I was in London. Mm-hmm. And while I was at the BBC, there was an editing job for the UNESCO, and I thought I could take that, with the idea that that was just a starting point so that I could start in France. And, well, in fact, that fell through because I think UNESCO moved the editing job to New York, closed their office in Paris, and I didn't want to go to New York. So afterwards, I had a hard time to find editing jobs in Paris. I did do one or two here and there. There was a lot less work at that moment. And so after 6 months of rather unsatisfactory work, you know, technically even less interesting than what I had in England, I went back to my original editor and asked him if he had any work. Anyway, I went down to see him and he said, oh yes, there's a job in Granada Television for zoo time.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to take the plane immediately tonight, or the train or whatever. So I took a plane, I arrived at 3 o'clock in the morning in Manchester and tried to find a hotel. Mm-hmm. And they say, you don't want a hotel, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, it's almost over the night, you know, no one would give me a hotel. And I said, yes I do, I have to start editing tomorrow, I can't edit unless I sleep. And so eventually I found a very small room in a hotel. I spent several weeks in, you know, Manchester, mm-hmm. editing zoo time, editing kangaroos and Carlo bears and all sorts of anteaters. And I mentioned that I found, in fact, the relation with the public in experimental film more interesting because one could show one's films in a variety of sort of places. I mean, this has been my case anyway, and I've shown films in festivals which are, or events which are not, I mean, not in commercial festivals with prizes, but I mean, I've shown them in film events with nothing to do with experimental film, you know, very, very varied public. And I remember saying this when I was in Millennium for the very first time, that this was much more interesting to me than to be a part of the art market. And then someone in the audience, and they're quite right, they say, do you think you're not part of the art market being in the Millennium? And I mean, I agree with them. The Millennium, it's not a part of the art market financially, but it is a part of the art scene, which is related to the art market. So they are right in a way. But it's not quite the same situation in the sense that that's not the only place my films are shown. You know, you have other possibilities, which don't bring you any money at all. You're definitely not in the art market financially. You can't earn a penny.
What do you think draws people into experimental filmmaking, knowing that it's such a almost a masochistic kind of pursuit in many ways?
Well, I think people are there for many different reasons. And they're there for different lengths of time. A lot of people don't stay there very long. As soon as they find, I mean, especially today, I mean, most people are going into video because they hope to get on television. A lot of people have returned to fine art or gone into other fields. I mean, they haven't stayed in experimental film because precisely it's not very rewarding socially or financially. But for me, that's not quite what I'm looking for. I mean, it's a different type of work. Since first of all, you've got a photographic medium, which is different to working in paint. I mean, it's connection with reality, or it's relations you could establish with reality of a totally different level. And so, you know, it's not the same type of work at all. I mean, to me, you can't just move from one to the other without taking that into account.
Right.
But I don't know if that's the case of a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people may be on video in a way, with all the sort of playing around with the image. I'm not sure if it's not nearer to, and I think that's the reason why it's much more accepted in the gallery situation and in the museum situation. I'm not sure if it can't pretend to be in the same category as painting much more easily than cinema. And I'm not sure that's why, you know, I mean, how come that a lot of galleries will accept it? It's not only because it's easier to put on the machine, will accept what they call in France video art, but they won't talk about cinema art or accept the kind of meticulous relation with the material which you have to be involved with in order to do satisfactory work in film. Film image is a certain type of image. I mean, you can do certain things with that image, or you can work in a certain way which you can't do with video. You can simplify things. You see, there's no possibility, there's no confusion possible that you're going to, you know, become a well-known artist by doing experimental film. You know, you're left in peace in a certain way. No one's asking to.
But it seems that it presupposes that you have to earn a living doing something else.
Oh yes, but everyone does. I mean,
everyone does. So
there isn't anyone in any other situation. Yes, but in France it's no different. For instance, all the major French painters are in that situation. They're all teaching in art schools or
writers.
Unless they have a private income, which is rare, they're all in that situation. Nearly all the novelists, unless they become very famous as school teachers or university teachers, often school teachers.
So, would you think it would improve the situation then if filmmakers were to earn, be able to earn money from their films, or would it be a corrupting influence on it?
Well, it's a moot point as to whether it would be better or worse. One can't really tell. I mean, I remember Matisse saying that, you know, if he hadn't been able to earn his living from his painting, he would have just taken any old job in order to, you know, do what he wanted, not to make a compromise for his paintings. I mean, he was saying that is probably the situation what people have to do today, more or less suggesting that in his period it was different, that it was possible to do as he did. But for me, it was a way to have complete freedom in my own artwork. You know, I mean, I had a father who was, you know, working in publicity and working with images. And I could see that, you know, the kind of images which he was producing were, you know, for me, were great problems. I mean, I couldn't possibly, I mean, I would be very upset to have to promote that kind of work, you know, because it was on the same sort of field. And I remember as a very small child, he used to produce, let's say, three small models of, you know, these are big billboards which are about 40 yards long and I don't know how high, and they're put in the desert all along the Peruvian coast. And he used to show me the model before they were being selected, you know, and he'd say, show a model, for instance, of Goodyear Tower, and there would be three different designs. And he would say, you know, which one do you think is best, sort of using me as a, you know, as the general public, you know, vox pop test. And I would look at it, and I mean, I was only a kid, but I could see that they were all being exaggerated and distorted, and they were mannerist, and they were, you know, trying to make it look grander than it was, and you know, they were all false, it was all superficial. And I told my father, I said, they were appalling, all of them, all three. I mean, none of them looked like the tower really was, for a start. And he was very upset because he had what he considered a very good designer, you know, from Germany, who was paid a higher salary than he himself or anyone else in the company. Yeah. And he thought they were very clever because they were presenting these tiles in a good light. Mm. Whereas I was just looking at it and seeing the great just gap between what the tile really looked like. I mean, any kind of sort of point of view you could have about a tile as it really was. And, you know, without trying to be realist, I mean, to me it was just completely false view for obvious reasons, just to sell it, you know, which I resented tremendously. Mm. And I remember having other arguments about him, with him about, there were surveys at the time because he was in advertising, you know, about putting music in supermarkets, and they found out that in doing that people stayed in supermarkets longer, and they used to find out as well if they put some kind of goods like, say, toilet soap 3 or 4 times in a supermarket in different places, people would end up buying it, you know, as if you put it in one place it wouldn't, and things like this. And I had an argument with him. He said, oh, well, you'd be influenced by these kind of things just like anyone else. And I was always taking the opposite stance, saying, no, I don't need to consume all these things, and I won't, you know. And in fact, when I grew up, kept this sort of counterculture type of attitude.
So you're sort of reacting against what you see as false values and...
Yes, to me a waste of time and a very uninteresting type of life where one just consumes and one does what everyone else does.
So to get back then to this idea that even if a film such as yours could be sort of released in a sort of limited edition of 10 films and could be sold for, you know, £50,000 a time or whatever.
No, I mean, I'd be very glad because it would help me to work. I mean, I'd be able to make more films.
Would that be good for the experimental film?
Well, it would always depend how it would be done. I mean, if you would have to put pictures of naked women or something next door to it in order to sell it, then I would refuse, obviously, you know, which is how most products are sold.
Yeah.
If it could be done in terms which I would consider correct, in other words, presenting it for, you know, in a way which wouldn't be false or superficial or frivolous.
Yeah.
And in other words, the public would be told, would be, you know, the product would be announced as you know, the work would be announced as what it is, more or less. I mean, as near as, you know, you can never announce something, you can never describe anything accurately. You know, that's a fallacy, but at least you could present the kind of project which was involved and what kind of thing it is. I mean, without, you know...
No, but the art, the history, I mean, the film history would change. Because when painting becomes a market, once a painter has a kind of trademark, he's more or less pushed to reproduce.
Yeah.
And you could see most painters, that means they work in as much as they discover their trademark, and after they just repeat it.
Yeah.
And they repeat it, and they repeat it.
Or even some filmmakers could do that.
You could see that for, I mean, 10 years, 20 years, they do more or less the same thing. Well, you have some artists who agree or refuse that. But the best known artists probably fall more or less in this kind of pattern. Yeah. And I think the independent film avoids this kind of trap because you haven't got
there. Yeah, well, it avoids it. I mean, people don't do it for financial reasons, but I think too, I think the same kind of thing works in the sense of, you know, you can understand it. I mean, you can understand a filmmaker who's working in a certain line and who's producing quite good work in that line. I mean, are they going to risk, I mean, it is a risk, you know, to suddenly start to do something in a line which you don't really know whether you're going to be able to do something with it or not. You don't whether know, I mean, it may be something which you know is not going to be considered good given what people are interested in at the moment, even though perhaps you're interested in it. Are you going to take the risk of doing something which is going to be considered bad filmmaking by, you know, people which are seriously interested but do not think that's the kind of thing that should be done for the moment, or people which are going to say, you know, you've gone back on the kind of thing that you'd already, you know, you've gone back in your progress, you know, you're starting from scratch one because you're starting in a line which you don't know much about, so maybe don't control it too much, or, you know, there's, I think, the same kind of problem in film as well. I mean, to be willing to present work which may be very bad work, you know, to take the risk to do that.
But if the works did get sold for these colossal prices, like art, yeah. Wouldn't it then become part of the art market, which you actually don't want to be a part of?
Well, what would happen there is that the situation wouldn't be the same at all, in the sense that instead of, let's say, having 20, 30, maybe maximum 40 sort of filmmakers in France who are working really seriously, that is, without expecting any financial returns whatsoever,
yeah.
You would have 400 or 500 filmmakers tomorrow trying to make experimental films.
Yeah.
And the few filmmakers who are working seriously would disappear, they'd never exist, because the others would be so much more pushing and... Because experimental film is not taught in universities generally at all.
There's no money for...
And there's no money for any screenings in any university.
No, but
so it doesn't exist, but I think...
Sure, but potentially...
Well, potentially, I think that that... First of all, experimental cinema should be supported like the other arts, which it's not. And so it should be not only taught in places of learning, I mean, places of higher learning, I mean, could be universities, could be art schools, not necessarily in all of them, but in certain universities who are orientated towards the experimental arts. Certain art schools who are orientated towards visual art, which is to do with that. I mean, not necessarily all the art schools, but there should be certain art schools where you can, you know, have contact and see experimental films, and there should be certain universities where departments are active in that field. And to me, that isn't sufficient. I mean, the general public, I mean, anyone should be able to have access both to the classics or to past films which are considered significant today, and to the work that's been done which isn't necessarily recognised yet, or is, you know, they should be able to see also the new filmmakers who are coming, and the, you know, people who've done one film, and all that work should be shown in some capacity, and at least both in the capital and in main cities. I mean,
which means
for very minimum sums of money, the work could circulate in a way which would be very open, and to me that would be to the benefit of the population in general. It doesn't mean to say that hundreds of people would come, and I don't think for a moment you should worry, you know, if there are 10 people or if there are 50 people, because it's not, I mean, in relation to the money, no, but the relation to the money that's been spent on, say, dead arts like opera and I don't know what else, which maybe should be kept going. I mean, I don't say you should close the opera houses, but I mean, if, for instance, in, let's say in Avignon, we were given, let's say we have a very small audience, I mean, which is not always the case, but sometimes we have a small audience. But all I ask for is that I be given, per person that comes to my screenings, the same sum of money that the opera gets, per person that goes to the opera. And I would be able to buy probably at least 100 films every year, if not 200 or 300 films every year to be screened, you know, in rotation, or I'd be able to do very great events with the money if I could have the equivalent sum of money, but I'm not given anything like it.
Right, but presumably the argument is that there is no audience for experimental film.
It isn't because what I'm asking is the same sum of money per person that comes to my screenings in relation to the money which is given to the opera, per person who goes to the opera. And as I say, if I was, I would be given so much money, I would. It's as much as I want, I don't want any more.
Right.
You know, if I could just be financed like the local opera,
yeah.
Per person that comes. You know, I'm not asking for the sum they've got. I'm asking per person that comes in relation to what they get per person that comes,
yeah.
Which to me would be a fair... And I'd have so much money. I mean, experimental film would have enough money for the stage of its development at the moment. You know, you don't need more money than what you need. You know, you need enough money to do the screenings, to buy films, to build up a collection, you know, and to pay some of the people to do the work so the work's done correctly, which at the moment it's not.
Right. Thank you.
alone in my Mediterranean villa here in Tangiers. And here I am in the glamorous de-internationalized zone city, intercortisone, extra hormone, estrogenous, monstrosimony, corneo, super gilded city of Tangiers, in my rotunda, surrounded by Spanish antiques, and my parrot, Scheherazade, to whom I feed used rhinestone jewelry. And I am visited by my dearest super friend, Frances Francine. Sigh her name, sing her fame, ex-star of hermaphrodite, star of sideshows, and superstar of flaming creatures, a Jack Smith Cinema Rock presentation. Watch out for it at your nearest theater. What is that? Do I think I hear Francine at the door? At my great big gilded pure mahogany, foot thick Spanish Moroccan door with carvings? Let me just go mincing over to it and fling it open and see if Francine is there, because I'm expecting her for poisoned tea and cupcakes with suspicious green icing, and we lap it up, hoping that each other will die so we can pick each other's costume jewelry off. And it's just a fight between ladies to see which one succumbs, first of all, to the most super dangerous poisons, so the other one can get the other one's jewels, darling.
Mavis, darling, how nice to see you.
True, don't ever forget my pseudonym, my nom de plume, which I use in my super glamorous isolation here. My past is dead. Remember, I came out of nowhere, Francine. A woman from nowhere, like yourself. Francine, what is that? Is that sort of like a traveling costume?
Well, it's a two-piece ensemble. It can be used for evening, it can be used for a cape with a stole behind it.
Isn't that a little heavy for tropical?
Not particularly. It's lace of the finest.
This is a
fantastic.
True. But this is a difficult monsoon season.
Yes, but darling,
I think it would get sort of soggy, all that.
No, lace is always cooling.
That's right, yeah, I didn't think of that. True. Mohammed, bring us some cool, refreshing drinks.
Oh, lovely music.
That is your most spectacular Gusemeyer yet that you've ever whipped up together.
Thank you.
It's a gigantic gold turban. I don't know how to describe it. With a pink, half cascading down the half of the side of your body is this pink taffeta held in place by a shimmering brooch, and the other half of your body is covered with a cascade of lace. And your jewels.
I have never noticed until now how nice black looked upon you. And with that white, that lovely white flower stuck in the middle of your hair.
It's a water lily.
Very becoming.
It doesn't look like it's plastic, does it?
No, it doesn't, is it?
You'd never guess.
I was going to say how original. Out here, to find a water lily is a very rare thing.
I think I'll feed my parrots. Scheherazade, darling. Scheherazade, open up your disfigured beak. I think I have an old brooch that I'll give you today. Say it again, dear. Say it. Drag her off to the cellar. She became too obstreperous and overstimulated at the thought of one of my brooches. Ha! Drag her off, screaming. Let me serve you some poisoned tea, dear.
All right, darling, if you have some too.
Yes, dear, I'll have some too. Let me see. Let me just wave my ring around over it.
Mavis, get your dirty fingernails out of that cup.
No, I couldn't help it. I was opening my poison ring and some, and I happened to get my brooch happened to fall in it.
But take your brooch out, darling. We don't need any shrapnel in the coffee.
Well, we'll all be dead someday, won't we, Mavis?
Squirtly, dearie.
Mavis, what am I saying? I'm Mavis. I think I'll do a sensuous Near Eastern dance.